Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Brian E. Krim. He is the John M. Turner Distinguished Chair in the Humanities and an Associate Professor of History at Lynchburg College. And we're talking about his book, Are Germans, Project Paperclip and the National Security State. Brian, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you for having me.
This is a really interesting chapter in American history, to the point where when I started telling people about your book, I think people thought I was making stuff up or was being just sort of odd. But this is an incredible – what attracted you to the story? I know that, but I want to hear your version of it.
Well, I think, you know, like a lot of Americans, I'd always known there were these – you know, German scientists involved with NASA, and, you know, everyone, I think most people had at least come across Wernher von Braun.
Oh, yeah.
But it wasn't until I got to graduate school and I took a diplomatic history course, which wasn't even my real field. I did kind of modern Europe, that I wanted to blend, you know, what I was studying about, 20th century Germany with this mostly American history class. And I stumbled upon Project Paperclip and didn't realize just how in-depth it went and how many layers are within it beyond just, you know, the rocket team, that there was this gigantic intelligence operation that really extended for decades, not just for a few months after the war. So that just really piqued my interest. I always wanted to return to it, and I have in the last, you know, 5 or 6 years.
To set the stage for the audience, Project Paperclip takes place at the very end of World War II.
Right.
Ultimately, about 1,500 German and Austrian scientists, engineers, and technicians, and thousands of dependents are brought to America. That's shocking to people who don't know this.
It is, and I think it has to do with that so many of them blend in fairly well with the populations of the cities they're living in or near the Air Force bases, that it was a different than had there been perhaps a Japanese paperclip, which a lot of other people had even thought about doing. That, you know, it's something about already having a large number of German Americans here that it didn't tend to raise as many alarms as it could have.
Now, we have to talk about the motive. Why would they be doing this?
Well, there was a perceived, in part it's real, but I think a lot of it was perception, that the Germans had this quote-unquote, and this is something I found in the documents, a great German inventive mind, that they're somehow superior when it came to certain fields, whether it was jet propulsion, whether it was electric U-boats, or, of course, in rocketry. And there was, personal experience with this, because they had mastered a certain number of high-quality weapons, too few in number to make a difference, and they were wreaking some havoc, especially on civilians. So all the Allies had a plan to try to capture whatever they could that was still, you know, in crate or on the rocket stands or even the people themselves, and take advantage of that occupation zone that's allotted to them and try to catch up. You know, what are we missing out on? And for the United States, we stumbled upon arguably the greatest prize, which was the rocket team. In reality, though, we probably only caught up maybe several years worth of research. But in reality, as I kind of go into the book, and I think historians of actual science and technology, ones who really know the technical stuff, will tell you, the United States could have done much of what the German scientists did ourselves, and in fact, we did. So the perception was always a perception. In reality, I think their legacy is overstated.
One of the great things about your book is you fill in a lot of gaps in this story that I didn't know before. And one of the reasons we're also doing this is that the Russians were doing it. They were going around and collecting their own group of scientists. So there was competition between Russia and the United States.
There was, and this is in that twilight period where the Cold War isn't yet articulated, but everyone knows that there's going to be this at least intense competition, if not outright hostility. And the way the Russians went about it is they were a little more, they had to be a little more forceful, but also they...
Wait a minute, Brian. You have stories of them like just picking guys up in vans and then like sort of wafting them off to Russia.
Sometimes they would do that, and other times they would lure them with a big paycheck, yeah.
Okay, but they would also use attractive women to lure them, and it was like classic story. We, on the other hand, are just offering people like a good job.
A good job and citizenship. And despite, you know, even the thing we know about the Russians, the French were worse than anybody. They were absolutely the worst because they did all those things and more. And they would also threaten the families of the German scientists because they're closer. You know, they're across the border. So as bad as the Russians were, if you delve into the... You know, the bureaucracy, Americans will admit that the French were even more obnoxious about it. Go figure.
Now, how did we know, like, who were the best scientists to pick up? And I want to talk about Verna Ossenberg and the Ossenberg file.
Yeah, this is a case where, you know, people like Wernher von Braun were on people's radar, forgive the pun, because of intelligence. But many of the SS would eventually, as with other things, control so much of scientific research and development along with Albert Speer. And many of them knew, once the war was coming to an inevitable conclusion, that they're best left being on the American side of things or the Allied side of things, Western allies, as opposed to the Soviets. So Ossenberg knew this and it was his job as part of this, part of the division of the SS, to maintain a list of all technical specialists in the Third Reich to be used on a number of different projects. So he had about 15,000 names in hand and got some of that information to the Allies, Americans in particular, who then got the entirety of the list, which had been flushed down a toilet. You couldn't even make that up.
I know.
So it was a fact that was called the Blacklist, and we worked off of that for Paperclip, among so many other operations. And Paperclip, you know, was actually originally just meant for the rocket team, and then it kind of would expand later.
So how are these people initially vetted by the military, by our military?
Well, that's the thing. What I
know that's the thing. You go into this in depth in the book, and I find that really fascinating.
In this era where we talk about, you know, extreme vetting, here's a case where we did very little of that. We allowed the Germans to vet themselves, partially because we didn't think, at least the initial people in contact with them, didn't have the expertise to judge, are they really pulling the wool over our eyes, or are they as skilled as they say. And Wernher von Braun and some of his key functionaries, including his brother, who turned out to be an actual idiot. I mean, he was really not that. He was just a trained chemist and not much more. But we allowed the von Braun inner circle to dictate to the U.S. Army at the time who was valuable and who wasn't. And we took their word. And once they arrived in the United States, of course, the rocket team did prove its worth. But there are dozens of others who were either just sent back because they didn't live up to their expectations, or they were just given kind of run-of-the-mill engineer jobs that any graduate from Georgia Tech could take over. So it was a kind of a situation where the Germans dictated to us their skills and took advantage of this moment when we're just out to get who we could because of this competition with other allies, particularly the Soviets.
Now, I want to back up a bit and talk about National Socialism in science. What were the Nazis' attitude towards science and scientists? Because that sort of seems like, I know what their attitude towards artists were, which was not great. Yeah. And sort of scientists are very sort of, a lot are sort of in that sort of free thinking category. How did they deal with scientists?
Well, the Third Reich in the first few years initiated a program called Gleichschaltung, or coordination. And it's what happened with artists, and it's what happened with education, with every sector of the economy and, you know, the culture, where everything had to be subordinated to a National Socialist organization or worldview. Scientists were already somewhat accustomed to this because in order to be a university, who already had to be a little bit Nazified in the sense of joining certain student groups in order to get the jobs you wanted. So the challenge was you have a lot of the Nazi higher-ups who distrusted science because, as you say, they were free-thinking, but also had a very utilitarian view. We need them.
Right, right.
So if you can throw money at the sectors you need, they're going to be grateful, and especially in an economy that is still reeling from the Depression, well, German scientists enjoyed being on the, you know, under the government payroll. So there was a certain amount of amoral, I call it the amoral technocracy involved in here, that you are working what you think is for science's sake, And it doesn't matter that you're being paid by this government. And some would be adamant National Socialists, and many others would be completely indifferent. And you had quite a few that were hostile, but still, because of their skills, able to continue working throughout the war.
Let's take a close look at Wernher von Braun, because like you said, he's probably the most famous example, especially if you're a person of my age who actually remembers him with Disney. And actually, I ended up in a elevator once with him. And that's a long time ago. But Wernher von Braun was a fascinating character because he's very charismatic. But he was very close friends with Adolf Hitler. Adolf Hitler really appreciated his sort of visionary approach.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it was a mutual admiration society, because Wernher von Braun certainly benefited mm-hmm. from Hitler and even was awarded the title of professor personally from him. But he viewed them as and I think this is true. I don't think it's him trying to reinvent his past once he's in America. He actually did just see it as a vehicle toward his ultimate goal, which is space travel, and then he called it milking the golden cow. But he understood Hitler in a way I think maybe a lot of his other scientists' friends didn't, and that you had to appeal to his visual sense of the fantastic. And so he personally edited a series of films about the V2 and the V2 tests, and included some even animation to show that it was to improve what the results. So he's very clever in knowing that Hitler was a visual person. Anyone who knew his background would appreciate that, and he knew how to sell the military fantastic nature of rocketry while at the same time really looking at it as a mixed civilian and military project, which is how he viewed it in the United States. So he knew that if he could reach Hitler, he could skip a number of bureaucratic steps that others in his position, in a similar position, would have to go through.
Okay, there's that.
There's that.
But then there's the conditions of the slave labor at Peenemünde and elsewhere. That there's always this question, how much did von Braun know about? Because the conditions of the concentration camp workers who are working on these missiles, which are going to ultimately be sent over and bombing Britain, it was horrific.
It was absolutely horrific, and for anyone to say he didn't know, let alone sanction it, is fooling themselves. And that's kind of and I hear I have to give credit to the brilliant Michael Neufeld, who wrote the 2007 biography about von Braun, and it was it was Neufeld himself who actually found evidence in the archives connecting von Braun among others to slave labor at Bergen-Belsen, Dachau, and of course Russian POW labor was used at Peenemünde. So the notion that this was, as one of the survivors who wrote a biography an autobiography of his time in the camps, that it was some sort of immaculate conception, that the V2 was just, conjured up and not the result of 20,000 dead and among 60,000 slave laborers used, is someone who's still trying to perpetuate this myth of the good German and the fact that the Project Paperclip was, really just a bloodless and brilliant Cold War victory. I try to show that there was this element to it that is sometimes overplayed by investigative journalists, but also not considered enough among those who wrote the early histories of Paperclip.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Brian E. Krim. He is the John M. Turner Distinguished Chair in Humanities and an Associate Professor of History at Lynchburg College. And we're talking about his book. If you aren't familiar with this history, this is going to blow your mind. Our Germans, Project Paperclip, and the National Security State. Brian, one of the things that I found interesting about your book is obviously that you just didn't focus on Wernher von Braun, but there were lots of others like Otto Ambrose. The list goes on of people, Ernst Eckhart. Some of these had incredible, questionable backgrounds. And you really have to ask the question, like Ernst Eckhart had done cold resistant tests on human subjects. And you sort of read that in the cold light of day and you're going, oh my God, and we just brought him to America?
And so many, in fact, the entire aerospace medicine field was built on these horrific human experiments. And while many of the ones that we brought over were not, were knowledgeable about these experiments, and someone like Eckhart, who, you know, wound up kind of being used and then hidden away after we got what we wanted from them. But there was a number who wound up in Texas, where Randolph Air Force Base and San Antonio, where they set up this institute. All of them were using the research on human subjects from a number of camps, whether it was pressure experiments or the cold water experiments, how long could someone survive in cold water. All that science, it was mutually agreed upon by a number of nations that despite how it was acquired, it was good science and needed to be used. And we were the first to really kind of blur these medical ethical questions in a major way.
Wow.
And the ones that were too just difficult to keep in the United States because it was his past was going to be discovered, we sent them to Argentina, where we could use their science indirectly, or other parts of Central America, Latin and Central America. So it's never a question of a moral outrage. It's what can we get away with?
Really?
I don't think and I think anyone who knows Cold War history will understand that's kind of how we operated.
It was amazing also to read that corporations were anxious to access these German scientists too. People like in Bell Delphine Labs, you mentioned, right. Western Electric, Dow Chemical, they had like almost shopping lists of things that they wanted and were eager to have these people come and work here too.
Yeah, my favorite was the Bulova watch company.
Yes.
They literally just were, you know, going through the POW camps, like, I want that one, I want that one, I want that one.
Oh,
and it was
God.
Really these companies that got to Truman first and convinced him and he was kind of skeptical about the whole thing, but he was getting an earful from these major corporations about what they thought were tremendous advancements in a number of fields, in photography and chemicals and find mechanical things like watches, so more than maybe a national security argument, it was this economic argument that I think convinced Truman to at least go after a small number of scientists. And what he did not know is just how expensive his own executive order was going to be ultimately used for. But it was the Department of Commerce was in on paperclip from the very beginning for that reason.
But, and this is what's great about your book. I mean, your book is a very balanced and honest appraisal of the whole situation from all sides. But there were people within the government, State Department specifically, who were vehemently opposed to this program. I'm thinking about people like Samuel Klaus, I think. Was that?
Yes, the lawyer.
Yeah.
Who, he was a minor character in some earlier books that I came across, and I really wanted to give a whole chapter really to him on the State Department, because that's the part we don't hear about, is that there was opposition throughout the bureaucracy, even within the military, but also you might expect it from the State Department, who's in charge of immigration, and they have to live with the consequences of any embarrassing revelations or even security violations. So to have a chapter on these people, I think, was very important to the story. But for Samuel Klaus, I mean, he is Jewish, but and a number of the lawyers who were opposed to paperclip and other bureaucrats happened to be Jewish. But their fear was they weren't out to take revenge on these Germans. They generally feared that the Third Reich was in danger of becoming a Fourth Reich if you left it untouched. That they could resurrect themselves in Central America, or worse, in America, and that the Soviet Union is not the only threat on the horizon, that there is still one that's smoldering in the ashes. And I think that's really the State Department mentality, was that the Third Reich is defeated, but the German threat is ongoing unless you're very thorough and systematic about how you vet some of these high-quality scientists. They weren't opposed to it, paperclip, but they wanted it to be done within the law. Go figure.
Right. And what was also shocking, Brian, was reading about some of the military comments about these people who objected were definitely anti-Semitic.
They absolutely were. And there's a lot of work done about sort of the history of anti-Semitism within the U.S. military. And certainly the State Department has a long history of that, from starting with not allowing Jews to enter the country during the worst time moments of the 1930s and 40s. And so it's not surprising that that was an institutional obstacle for anyone opposed to paperclip who happened to be Jewish, and they would write about it, and many people would actually attest to this, and their interviews are now in the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum, dealing exactly with opposition to paperclip. And this was something that was used during the McCarthy era as well. Right. Whenever there was this question of why is it that the Russians are ahead of us in these particular areas, they'd always go back to Jews in the State Department who didn't let us get enough Germans, as if that was really the issue. So it's kind of shocking to read how this Project Paperclip in these first 2 years, 45 to 47, would be used as a weapon by McCarthy in the early 1950s.
How did J. Edgar Hoover feel about this whole thing?
Well, he started out as an opponent of paperclip because he had just spent World War II fighting Nazi spies and doing a very good job, actually, of breaking up some very intricate Nazi spy rings in the United States. So when he was presented with this idea of, guess what, we're going to bring in these Nazis,
yeah,
he was horrified. But then he was given a very detailed and personally oriented presentation about paperclip and what the Soviets were doing, and it was done really to just for him to kind of show the evils of communism and why these Nazis were actually good. He ate it up, and he immediately, within a month, completely turned around his worldview on this and made sure the FBI became a helper to the military instead of an obstacle, although there were still a lot of good FBI agents that were very careful in their investigations. But he became a personal enemy of Klaus and others who he thought were sympathizers of the Soviet Union, or because they were Jews, not sufficiently read in on what it means to have an American security state.
Now, when Paperclip goes public, and it had to eventually,
yeah,
what was the public's reaction?
Well, I was kind of surprised that it was overwhelmingly negative, but it also didn't endure past what we might call a couple news cycles today. So people, when you're presented with the idea, do you think it's a good idea to bring a bunch of Nazis to the United States? Most Americans are going to say no, especially in 1946 when this is coming out. But if you ask them, how upset about it are you, it's not going to rank very high. So the Army kind of understood that it probably would be viewed negatively, even with the very, the way they walked it out was very deliberate, and they invited reporters in, they tried to control the narrative. But I think they understood that it was going to not go over well at first, but over time, people didn't support it or hate it, they just became indifferent. And the Cold War rhetoric had ramped up to the point where anything could be justified. Germany was no longer seen as an enemy, and other than people like Albert Einstein or the NAACP or Rabbi Stephen Wise and high-profile Jews, there wasn't much vocal opposition.
You had mentioned, we're going to finish up here because we just have a few minutes. You'd mentioned Japan before. Why wasn't there ever Project Paperclip for Japanese scientists?
No, I was curious about that, and part of it has to do with the fact that Japanese scientists were needed for rebuilding Japan in a way that I think German scientists were too as well. But General MacArthur was in charge of the occupation of Japan, and he actually wanted to use this talent that existed in Japan to resurrect their economy. So there was that element to it, but also there were other issues. One, racial issues that a lot of American bureaucrats in charge of the paperclip for Germany said, well, we can't possibly do this for the Japanese because, one, we don't think they're as good, and two, Americans won't accept communities of Japanese people living in Ohio or Alabama or wherever they're going to be. So there was an idea that, one, they're not good enough, which turned out not to be true, of course, but also that there was going to be a racial backlash that you would not have with German scientists. You did occasionally would have some Japanese scientists brought in on a individual basis, but it was kind of a bureaucratic opposition to this that I have to say a lot of it is grounded in racism.
One of the weirdest things, and you bring this up, is Wernher von Braun and Disney. He was actually on the Wonderful World of Disney, and I can remember that as a kid. It was when he did a whole little thing about exploring space.
And not just him, a lot of his team, the other members of his team who couldn't speak English quite as well, but they're in the background. He was the biggest proponent of space travel even before his capture. That's just one of the things that got him in trouble with the ISS, is that he was accused, rightfully so, I think, of being more interested in space travel than the immediate military applications for the war. So when he came to the United States, he started writing science fiction. He started to offer himself up to magazines like Collier's and American Life and some that are not around anymore. But he captured the attention of Disney, who thought he could combine this brilliant animation with something else in between science and science fiction, which is, I think, the world that Wernher von Braun lived in is in between those two things.
That's still one of the weirdest photographs in the world, is Disney and Wernher von Braun. We're completely out of time. My guest tonight has been Brian E. Krim. He's the John M. Turner Distinguished Chair in Humanities and an Associate Professor of History at Lynchburg College. And we've been talking about his book. It's a fascinating read, Our Germans, Project Paperclip and the National Security State. Brian, it's been a real pleasure.
It's been a pleasure for me, too. Thank you very much.
You listen to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.